You're listening to On the Same Page, a podcast from the Jefferson Madison Regional Library.
Hello, welcome back to another episode of On the Same Page. I'm your host, Abby, and Erica will join me for book chat a little later on in the episode. Since this is coming out on November 1st, I do want to remind you that Election Day is coming up. It will be Tuesday, November 6th. If you're not sure where your polling place is or what will be on your ballot, I will include links to that kind of information in the show notes. Coming up later in the episode, we have a recording of a program that took place at the Northside Library over the summer. Visiting author Madeline Uranek will read from and discuss her book, How to Make a Life, A Tibetan-American Family and the Midwestern Woman They Adopted. And she brings with her some of her Tibetan friends, as well as members of the local Charlottesville Tibetan community. We're really excited to be able to share that with you today, but before we get into that, we've got book chat.
What did you read?
I read the final book in Hallie Black and Cassandra Clare's Magisterium series.
Is this because you were on a roll from Halloween reading?
No. This is kind of, they'll probably hate me for saying this, they're like American Harry Potter.
Okay.
It's like teen boy goes to a wizard school. Didn't really know he was a wizard before that.
I mean, who does?
So they started in the same place, but they definitely took some different turns, which was interesting, and this was the culmination for the series. I liked it a little better than the fourth book. I didn't like the way that one ended. I do like the way this one ended, mostly. It was very interesting. But yeah, excellent read, like, for Harry Potter or all of your fantasy wizarding J through YAs. I think it's technically J, so not aiming at a slightly younger market. Not
somewhere in between, so like middle grade?
Yeah, so not quite as violent or graphic or detailed in.
So would you say it's also a good read alike for Gregor the Overlander?
Yes, I love Gregor the Overlander. Yes, so it's called The Golden Tower.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, excellent.
What did you read?
Well, since election season is upon us, I read One Person, No Vote by Carol Anderson. And that was just sort of a chronicling of all of the different means of voter disenfranchisement through the ages in the United States specifically. So that was, I mean, it was a bummer, but it was enlightening. You know, they're the things you don't think about, and it talks about how things that are pushed as preventing, you know, voter fraud, which occurs virtually never, are really just a means of disenfranchisement. And so mm-hmm. It was really interesting to see it mapped out that way.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's been in the news a lot lately.
Yeah. What else did you read?
I read 21 Lessons for the 21st Century.
Nice.
And this is a historian by training, taking a look at the future kind of through not a historical lens, but like using what he knows about what has become of societies in the past, in addition to like science, current scientific findings in global warming and things like that, and kind of seeing where we might end up if we take action, if we don't take action, things like that. It was very interesting. I really liked it. I love the surprise ending because he gets to the end, he's like, well, what can you do if you feel like the world's ending, essentially? And he was like, have you heard of mindfulness? And I was like, have I? So it was like, secret ending, meditation will save the world. But his point was like, maybe you're too old or it's too far in the future when this catastrophic whatever is going to happen.
Right.
And you feel, you know, like you don't have the power to change it because you're just one human in a sea of humans. But if you can focus on making this moment good with the time that you have, which is kind of what mindfulness is, then it might help. Yeah, nothing really as far as like fixes.
Right.
But definitely thinking through some problems in a different way. What's your second one?
I read Where the Crawdads Sing by Delia Owens. This checks off that historical fiction box for me.
Hey!
It takes place in like the 50s and 60s in a coastal North Carolina like marsh in nearby community. So it follows Kaia Clark, who is kind of a wild child, sort of. She like grows up in the marsh with her family, and like at the beginning she's watching her mother walk away, and like she keeps waiting for her to return, but slowly all of her older siblings are leaving until it's just her with her dad, who is abusive, which is why everyone's got, he's not abusive towards her, but has been toward everyone else, because she's like, I think she's like 7 when everyone leaves and she ends up on her own.
So all her siblings leave at once?
One by one, but within the space of 6 months, or around 6 months after her mother leaves. She had like 5 older siblings. She goes to school one day in her life and then dodges the truant officers for like a few weeks until they finally give up. So she really raises herself on the marsh. And because of that, everyone in the small town nearby just know her as Marsh Girl. And you know, she's really kind of, she's isolated physically by being alone in the marsh, but then she's also pushed away by all of the local folks who know her as the like wild marsh girl. But she befriends one person who also lives kind of in the marsh, but is like, he's her age, but he goes to school and he starts bringing her books and he teaches her how to read, and he brings her like his science textbooks, and she becomes this like self-educated, incredible naturalist. And then like it's tied into this murder mystery when she's like in her early 20s, and it all comes together and it's
cool.
But yeah, it's mostly just the story of her really like creating herself on her own in the marsh by learning as much from the marsh as she is from the books, until she's able to basically tell the story of the marsh to other folks.
It reminds me of a nonfiction book that has similar themes. Mm-hmm. It's The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. So like limited schooling, limited resources, but he found like a 40-year-old American physics textbook or something crazy like that, and he taught himself how to build windmills that could power his whole village. And
yeah, it's a similar idea
by collecting junk.
Yeah,
over time. So yeah.
Yeah, and she collects like feathers and like shells and all of these things, and develops like a great artistic ability to draw and paint them. And so yeah, she's sort of like a John Audubon of the marsh.
Cool.
All right.
Hey.
Okay, up next we're going to hear from Madeline Uranek as she discusses her book, How to Make a Life, a Tibetan American Family and the Midwestern Woman They Adopted.
Good evening. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. Welcome to Northside for those of you who this is your first time. We're honored to have with us tonight visiting author Madeline Uranek and her dear friend Tenzin Kalsang in the back room. The heroine of Madeline's book is entitled How to Make a Life, a Tibetan Refugee Family and the Midwestern Woman They Adopted. We're also delighted to welcome members of the Tibetan Association of Charlottesville, whom we will also meet this evening. Writer, educator, and world traveler, Wisconsin native Madeline Uranek joins us this evening in the midst of a book tour. We are absolutely delighted to have them both here this evening to hear them share their remarkable and inspiring story of friendship. Thank you very much, Madeline.
Thank you all so much for coming. You are really in for a special treat tonight, because not only do I have all the way from Wisconsin a representative of my family, in fact, but because of the Tibetan Association of Charlottesville has been so kind to support and host, you are going to hear from all of the members who are here. So usually we have a question and answer, and Tenzin Kalsang is so brave to get up, and can you imagine doing a question and answer when you don't know what question people are going to ask in a foreign language? Anyway, she's so brave, and she's done fabulous. But she is so happy also tonight because she has all of her friends from the Tibetan Association of Charlottesville here, and it's going to be a very rich program. So what I hope to do is to tell a little bit of the story of how I met Tenzin Kalsang and how I got involved with Tibetan culture. And then I'm going to have people from the association come up, and you may ask questions. So while I'm talking, think of questions. Coming to Charlottesville especially has made me very poignant, because you've been in the newspaper a lot, and I know that the people of Charlottesville are just full of heart and hope, and that's the Charlottesville I want to meet. And I also know, as I travel around the world, that's what you find, especially if you go to places of trouble. You find people who are full of great heart and hope. So I will share this story of the book. First of all, since I have so many native Tibetan speakers here, I will introduce them all in a minute, but I would like Nawang Thakmi, will you come up here, and will you please teach us how to say hello in Tibetan, because why should you hear it from me? You can hear a real person. You say it, and then we'll say it, and then you say it again, and we'll say it again, okay?
Tashi Dele.
Tashi Dele.
Tashi Dele.
Thank you very much. We are going to hear a lot more from him, and this means auspicious greetings. So you can say it in the morning, in the afternoon. People said it to one another as they came in. So Tashi Dele. Okay. So remember, because at the end I'll ask you. Okay. If you can remember. So first, just a little bit about how does a person get so interested in one culture? So I've lived in Wisconsin for the last 50 years, and when I first came, I found a little folk art center where I studied folk dance and folk crafts and festivals and foods and how people used to make their own fun. And because I worked and volunteered at Folklore Village, I got a fellowship to go to Sweden, and I was in Sweden for a full year studying bygdekultur, and that's village culture, which of course includes folk dancing every night. And then I went on after that to a summer of folk dancing in Poland. And because I had those two experiences, I got an invitation to teach English in Japan, and I was in Japan for 3 years. So all 3 years I studied Japanese, and Japanese is one of the languages I've studied. I've studied many cultures. That doesn't mean I speak many cultures. And because I had those experiences, I applied for a job at the state of Wisconsin as the international education director, and I worked there for 16 years doing international programs with teachers. Then, because I did that and I was getting older, I thought, you know, I don't want to sit in a cubicle my whole life. I want to go out and really see the world. So I applied as a late in life Peace Corps volunteer. You know, you think they're like 20, and I was more like 60. But anyway, you still hike up mountains. And I was in a tiny mountainous country of Lesotho, which is entirely surrounded by South Africa. And because I did that, then I was able to work as a staff of Peace Corps, and they assigned me to another country I'd never heard of. I'd never heard of Lesotho in southern Africa. I'd never heard of Turkmenistan. And I couldn't have told you where Kyrgyzstan is on the map of the stans, you know, the 15 former Soviet republics. Well, now I can name all 15 stans. But then I took a little break, and I went back to Wisconsin, and my friends asked me this. Now, this is a very American question. People don't ask you this. Americans like to ask most, least, best, worst, what was that? So anyway, they asked me this, and I thought of all of the countries where I had been, and I thought, you know, my favorite country is Tibet. Which was a strange thing, because I've never been to Tibet. In fact, in those days, I barely even knew anyone who'd been born in Tibet. And, you know, maybe you've seen these prayer flags here and there, or some signs, Free Tibet. Anyway, I didn't know anything about Tibet. But the reason that I answered that way is because of one woman, But this is Tenzin Kelsang. And one day in my office, I was working late in Wisconsin, and there was a woman who was dusting my cubicle. And she had a beautiful black braid down her back, and I asked her where she was from, because a lot of people in the cleaning crew that came in after hours, they were from different countries, and I would ask them. Anyway, she said she was from Tibet, and I went, Tibet? Oh, I felt surprised, because I never met anyone from Tibet. I know it's very difficult to come from Tibet, and because I felt very guilty, because I had heard that there were 100 Tibetan refugees, they were coming to Madison, and there was a Tibetan resettlement project, and I meant to sign up, but oh my gosh, they must already be here. I had it, that, you know, one of those things. And so anyway, I asked her if she was one of those 100, but she said no, she actually said that she had come from Charlottesville, Virginia. So we came back 25 years later to kind of meet some of her friends that have come to say hello to her after she's been gone 25 years, and that's why we're here today. So first, we weren't really that great friends. She would ask me questions, and a lot of times I didn't know the answer. She'd ask me about mortgages. Well, I didn't even own a house, and she'd ask me about where her children were going to come over pretty soon, and where should she rent a house, and where were their good schools? I had no idea, and you know, I was single person, and anyway, she asked lots of people, fortunately, and she got some good answers. So, I didn't know this history then, but over time, I learned a little bit about Tibet. One of the things you see in cultural Tibet, you can call it now, where it was in China, where it still is in China, is huge. China in the 1950s and 40s was growing so fast, and maybe we didn't know it, but they needed these resources, and they didn't have respect for the Tibetan religion or any religions, you know, in the Soviet era. And so there's a lot of history. But in the 1950s, the Chinese Liberation Army began making these incursions into Tibet and really taking life and land and destroying the monasteries. These monasteries have such an amazing history, thousands of years, just handwritten sutras and scriptures, and the monks were the educated class. And anyway, they began imprisoning the monks, killing the monks, imprisoning activists, killing activists, and finally it was no longer safe for the Dalai Lama, who was only 19 years old at that time, to be there, and he fled with a retinue of people, and then there was resistance. It wasn't like the Tibetan people, you know, just let the Chinese come in, but it became so dangerous and the destruction became so devastating that hundreds of thousands of people followed him as he left Tibet. And these were incredibly, you can see that the around Tibet, Nepal, Bhutan, India, very mountainous countries. This was an incredibly dangerous trek, and many people lost their lives. And you will hear tonight from people who made this journey as a child, and all of the people here, their parents made that journey. This is a modern picture. It didn't look like that. We have very, very few pictures of the journey. But in modern day, Tibetans continue to leave China, or some go back because, you know, they can't go back legally, illegally. There is increasingly parents in the Tibet side send their children, because there are many Tibetans in Tibet, you know, many Tibetans left Tibet, but they send their children to the children's schools, because in China, you cannot study Tibetan in school. So the Tibetan children, the children who are ethnically Tibetan, learn Chinese in school. So, but if they come to Northern and some of these settlements in India, then they can learn Tibetan language and culture in these settlements. So each one of these little black dots is a settlement. They're in Bhutan and in Nepal, but Tenzin Kelsang's family ended up way down in a settlement called Bailakupe in the south
south of India. And she was one of the first babies that was born in that settlement. So some people have called these settlements the most successful refugee settlements in the world. They were brilliantly organized. At first, they really struggled because the people weren't in cooperatives in Tibet, but they organized themselves in India and Nepal in cooperatives. And it's just in my book, I talk about how this worked with 100 families in a settlement. So I didn't meet Mi'kmaq Dorje until 5 years later. He is Tenzin's very wonderful husband, and he told me many stories. And in his head, he also knows many old stories of folk stories. And I'll read you from the book just a little bit of his story. This is just a piece of it. So it's 1959, okay? And his family is escaping. So at 2 a.m. on an overcast night in December 1959, the three families, him and his brother, crept out their back doors as the village slept. They led their burdened yaks as quietly as they could through 2 feet of snow, heading toward the foothills, gorges, and ridges that rose quickly into the Himalayas beyond. The falling snow soon whipped into a fierce blizzard, blinding them so that they could not look back on the village they would never see again, but obscuring their tracks from any Chinese soldiers who might discover their absence. They headed in the direction of Bhutan. I'll put up the old picture. In an hour before their departure, Tempa, the brother's wife, gave Mi'kmaq a hand of moistened, roasted barley. "Put this in your pocket," she told him. Hours later, when Mi'kmaq complained he was hungry, she reminded him, "Eat your sampa." He put his hand in his pocket, but it was empty. As he had stumbled and fallen in the snow in the early morning darkness, the small ball of grain must have dropped out. Despite the blizzard, they kept looking backward. Mi'kmaq's sister Minky, her husband, and her husband's older parents should have caught up with them at the end of the village. Mi'kmaq's family assumed the elders were slowing the group down. As they reached the summit, the blizzard became life-threatening, with screaming winds that hurled blinding chunks of snow and ice. Landmarks disappeared. The group decided to turn back to Samar, a village through which they had just passed, praying the storm might slow down any soldiers in pursuit. In the confusion of turning around, 7 of their yaks not only turned, but kept on descending back toward their home in the valley. The gray and black beasts disappeared into the whiteness, carrying not just food and blankets, but all of the family's wealth, silver and copper coins and heirloom jewelry of silver, amber, and turquoise. In Samar, the men yanked out and tied up the single tent that remained, its hand-sewn edges flapping furiously in the wind. Exhausted, Mi'kmaq fell asleep inside the tent, his head on his mother's lap, while the men slept outside sitting up in the relentless, blowing snow. In the morning, they still saw no sign of Minky and her group. Heartbroken, the family faced the probability that Minky had been captured by the PLA. It would be 5 decades before Mi'kmaq would learn what happened to her. Mi'kmaq's legs were so frozen from the brutal night in the cramped position that he could not walk. Namdal, his brother, lifted him atop a yak. High above the blowing snow, the 13-year-old rode over the crest of the Himalayas and into the kingdom of Bhutan toward an uncertain future. Now, people in California, Ohio, and in India are trying to collect these oral histories of the elders. They are amazing stories. Many of the elders don't speak English fluently, but they speak Tibetan fluently, and just their dialect is precious to collect. Of course, Tenzin has a story. She will tell you her story. But she always told me it wasn't interesting. Oh. And these stories, they didn't tell me like in a paragraph. It was bits and pieces over the many years. And it was usually the children, if I asked a question, the children would tell me the answer. You know, so it was so hard for me to try to get the answer from Mi'kmaq or Tenzin. But Tenzing's story, we'll go back to India where she's living and she has her four children. In 1989, Tenzing in Myanmar began hearing rumors that 1,000 Tibetan refugees from settlements in Nepal and India would be able to enter their names in a special U.S. immigration lottery. Tenzing, the young woman who was born and raised in the dusty, if successful, settlement, looked at her four small children and said to her husband, "Let's try." And by that time, more than 110,000 refugees lived in 47 settlements, and each Tibetan refugee family was allowed to submit only one name to the resettlement lottery. Families debated who had the best chance of being selected. And from among 15,000 people who finally applied, the Central Tibetan Administration in Dharamsala carefully tried to choose a balance between the refugees who had come most recently from Tibet and didn't have any land because the government was no longer giving them land, and those who had been a long time, and between people who were largely illiterate and people who had special skills, and between family heads and single people. So they looked for strong men and women ages 18 to 45. And miraculously to Tenzing, her name was drawn. I was shocked. I was scared. At first, I didn't want to go. But she had little awareness of the joy and relief felt by scores of people who'd long lobbied the U.S. government in the Tibetan cause. And she wrestled with her choice to go or to stay. And she looked to her husband, who said calmly but firmly, "Let's stay. We don't have a lot of money, but we have enough food." Her parents and her older sisters, concerned that she would be leaving not only them, but the four kids in their care, wondered how they could possibly manage without her. Yet all the neighbors and friends crowded around her and envied her chance to be one of the lucky 1,000. So Tenzing was bewildered by the urgency and enormity of the decision before her. As she delayed, the first groups began departing Bailakupe, America bound. Batch one, batch two. And you might guess, she did come. 4 or 5 years later, she was able to bring her family. And as soon as I saw these kids, oh my gosh, they were so cute and they're middle age. Just about like the age of Sepe back there. They were so respectful and quiet, and I went like, oh, I'm an educator, I'm a teacher, I'll be able to help now. Well, you can see how delighted they are to be with me that day. Don't look very happy. This is our first outing to Milwaukee. Ladun, the daughter, isn't even in the picture. Didn't want to be, which had more to do with being a teenager than being Tibetan, right? But I got really involved with kids largely because, like many refugees, immigrants, asylees, when you come to a new country without your language and your certification and your networks, you get menial jobs. And Tenzing and Myanmar, between the two of them, had 5 jobs. Mm-hmm. A day job, sleep a couple hours, a night job, and then on the weekend job. Like cleaning a church or something like that. And I had no idea that cleaning jobs were so difficult, that it's so hard to work without sleep, and they're very dangerous. You handle a lot of chemicals. Of course, there's no protection or, very few labor unions. And I never thought about how lonely they are. If you have a night job and you're in an empty building every night, I really had just so much respect for them. But in the meantime, I was having so much fun with these kids. We traveled, we did lots of things around Wisconsin. I taught them a lot of bad habits. I made a lot of mistakes because I didn't have kids. So I just did things like, I told them they couldn't watch TV, or I'd always turn off TV. But if you don't speak English, TV is one of the quickest ways to learn language and culture. So, the ESL teachers became the heroines of our life, and the kids are still in touch with a couple of them who also, of course, really liked these kids. Well, of course, everyone became a U.S. citizen, Tenzing first. We celebrated each one. But in this time, this family was giving me so many gifts. And one of the gifts they gave me was that it, not just learning about Tibet, but they kind of gave me my grandparents back. Because my grandmother and grandfather, Adam and Anna Juranek, came from Polish-Czech border, Austro-Hungary Empire in 1920. And, you know, they were deceased. I hadn't really known them, but I realized that was the same family that had to learn a language. The kids were ashamed that their parents spoke a broken English. The mother never learned English, and they worked so hard. I felt like if they were in conversation with Mi'kmaq and Tenzing, they would just have so much to talk about. I was so lucky. Another thing was that as the family was here, everything changes so fast, and I just happened to be there during that time when things are changing so fast. And one of the first things that change, you can imagine, is the language, right? The kids grow up completely fluent in English. And at the Saturday school in Madison, Wisconsin, kids learn Tibetan as a foreign language, right? So even though maybe their parents speak it, it's very rare, and I hope that Samduk Law will tell you that how she does it in a family to get your kids to be bilingual, where, you know, you kids tend to answer you in English. So how do you get them to continue their Tibetan? So one of the things that fascinates me is traditions and culture. Like, how do you choose the ones, you know, which ones are going to stick and which ones disappear? Ones disappear before you even know they're gone. Others of them you really fight to retain, and you really want your kids to understand where they came from. And of course, Tibetan Buddhism. How many of you have experience with meditation or Buddhism? Oh my goodness, that's where everyone came from tonight. Well, good, you can educate me something about this, because in almost every home, and certainly I'm staying tonight with Samduk Butila and her daughter and family, there is a beautiful shrine, whereas I was joking that probably no Tibetan families have a dining room, because that room that's a dining room maybe in your house is a Tibetan shrine in their house, and there's just so much history and culture in Madison, and you'll have to tell me about Charlottesville. There's a beautiful Tibetan Buddhist a temple, Deer Park, which most people in Madison have never been to, even though it's amazing architecture that artisans from India came over. So the book talks about the many gifts that I receive, because I think so often we think when we meet a refugee family, we're going to help them, right? But you know how that works, is that they can quickly see, maybe you need a few things too. And I think they saw missing parts of me, you know, that I hadn't had a kid, that I wasn't very spiritual. And one of the great gifts in 2005, the three boys announced to me, their mother's idea, of course, their mother's very smart, but that they were going to take me and my sister to India. They're going to pay for everything. They're going to be my guides. And all of a sudden, the two of us didn't know the language. These guys are speaking Hindi and English and Tibetan. And they took us to the three of the Tibetan communities. I joked when I came home that I went to India, which has millions of people, and I didn't meet a single Indian, you know. But it was a fantastic experience for them. Of course, I thought they were, you know, showing us India, but some other things were going on that kind of went right over my head. But I was able to see, you know, some of these customs in context. So when I came back to Madison, I was even more interested in seeing these things. And tonight we are so lucky to have someone who's going to tell us about this. It's Lobsang, right? Lobsang is the one who's doing this amazing Tibetan tonka painting, which is just such an intricate art, but one, unfortunately, that doesn't really translate well as a living to the U.S. And you study for 5 years to do this, and one of the sons did that. And of course, I, as one of the gifts, I'm getting closer and closer to the Dalai Lama. You'll have to read the book. But I think this book is about race and class and ethnicity. And one of my cultural errors is if I look at someone who's cleaning the floors, I don't say, oh my, there's someone that could probably introduce me to the Dalai Lama and open has the keys to all of the monasteries. But she did, and people do. And we make such assumptions when we see people of what they will understand or what they can give us or how it doesn't have any relationship to our life. And that was just a wonderful, wonderful lesson. Well, as you can see, maybe this had something to do with the subtext that was going over my head while we were in India. And another gift I have is a changed attitude about arranged marriages. I asked my own mother, could you have arranged a better marriage for you know, your kids than we did for ourselves? And she said, you're darn tootin'. So, but, you know, even then, you know, these incredible weddings, and this is not, one of my messages is I didn't have to go across the ocean to find this culture. This culture is in Charlottesville. This culture is in Madison. This culture is in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And other cultures, not just Tibetan, other cultures are all around us. And this is in Madison, Wisconsin. It was actually in a Jewish center, so they didn't want to cover the Jewish, the Israeli flag with, you know, with His Holiness picture. So, you know, in the United States, you get this wonderful combination. This is a wedding in Nepal that I attended, and I actually went to Nepal kind of, I don't know, assumptive American that I am, that I was so afraid that Ladun, Tenzin Kelsang's daughter, who I knew and loved, was going to marry someone she hadn't even met, that I thought maybe I should go along, you know, and if the guy was a jerk, you know, I would, you know, like they say, is there anyone here who, you know, I would jump in? Well, you might see that I didn't, and he's a wonderful guy. And I had to end the book, and I also have to give people a chance to come up and share some of their culture. So I ended the book in 2010 with the first grandchild of Tenzin Kelsang, who is baby Chosang. You can figure out how old she is, and she also is speaking Tibetan and English. So I'll just read a little something to transition over into the discussion. So another gift the family gave me, one of many gifts, is that I did decide to go into the Peace Corps late in life. And inspired by Tenzin, Mi'kmaq, and their family, I approached my Peace Corps years in dry, dusty Lesotho, Africa, with a new openness, aware, even from the first day there, of how my life was already connected to people I had not yet met. I felt ready to learn what they had to teach. I knew, somewhere in the mountain villages with thatched rough huts, that families awaited me, no matter how fragmented they might seem, some without parents, perhaps just a grandmother or a neighbor caring for orphan children. And beyond Lesotho, there would be other families or other configurations, each different from the one preceding, but all needing environs in which to flourish. Our shared future, the barometer of global strength in humanity, depends on whether these families will be nurtured by compassion, care, and empathy. All families have something to teach each other. If global issues such as violence, pollution, and overpollution exist in microcosm at the family level, so do solutions. So the gifts that we give one another can ease suffering, engender hope, even shorten wars. So we are going to take the Dalai Lama's words, love and compassion are necessities, not luxuries. Without them, humanity cannot survive. And I'm going to thank you for this part. And Namang La, will you please come and tell us how to say thank you? Okay, he's going to pronounce this hard to pronounce word so you know how to say thank you. One more time, it's so hard. Now, how good a teacher was he? Do you remember how to say hello? Somebody does. Tashi Dele. Okay, everyone, one more time. Tashi Dele. Okay, all right. So, I hope you will read the book because it has too many stories to tell in a short time. And in Wisconsin, a portion of the book sale go to the Wisconsin Tibetan Association. Tonight they will go to the Tibetan Association of Charleston. And if you want me to sign your book, it's helpful if you, well, I don't have those little post-its. But anyway, it's helpful if you spell it for me. And it's $23 tonight. We're going to kind of gloss over tax a little bit. And if you write a check, it's to Global Maddie, and then I'll settle up with the association. If you want to write to me about, for any reason, I love to correspond with people who are reading, and I do, like every writer in the world, have a website and a blog, so feel free to take any of the papers about that. And now we are going to pull some chairs up, and we are going to invite some really amazing people to come up here. First, Mr. Nawang Thakme, will you come up and sit here? How do you pronounce your last name? I said Thakme? Thakme? Okay. He has worked since 1996 as a research librarian for Tibetan Buddhism Contemplative Studies at the University of Wisconsin Library. Have a seat. And before that, he taught Tibetan language and Buddhism at the university. So he came to Charlottesville in 1993. That was the same time that Tenzin Kelsang came, right? And you remember her, how yes. beautiful and how young you were. And so he came from the Ladakh Tibetan refugee settlement in northern India. And he's a board member of the Tibetan Association of Charlottesville. And then I would also like to invite up in another chair Mrs. Samduk Bhuti. And Mrs. Samduk Bhuti is president of the Charlottesville Tibetan Association. So her parents in small, high altitude Tingri, which is in the Usang province of Old Tibet, wanted her to be able to learn the Tibetan language and culture. So when she was 8 or 9 years old, remember people might not know exactly when their birthdays were, they arranged for her to escape to India, walking the dangerous journey over the Himalayan mountains with a small group of other children and adults. In Dharamsala, India, she attended the famous Tibetan Children's School, and in 1999, she came to the U.S. on a visa for work and study. And since 2004, she's lived in Charlottesville with her husband, James, and their daughter, Tenzin Sepe. There's Tenzin Sepe. And her son, Kunchak Rinchen, who is reading books like he should be. He's a reader. Readers are leaders. So he's on his way. And a third, I like a chair for Mr. Lobsang Dongdup. He escaped from Tibet when he was 14 years old. And he spent time in Tibetan refugee settlements in Nepal and India before coming to Charlottesville in 2002. And in Dharamsala, he did traditional religious paintings, the Tonka, at the renowned Nobilinka Institute of Tonka Painting. And anyway, he will share with that. I'm so glad I had one slide of it. And he is currently working as a contractor, employing lots of people, and he serves on the board of the Tibetan Association of Charlottesville, and he's a family man with a toddler. Right, and then I don't have a lot of background about Jamyang Nima. Will you join us up here too, please? Okay, and you can tell us your story. Someone will have a question for you. And let me see. Sepe, would you like to answer some questions too? Maybe people would like to know about young people and what you think of this. Okay, and finally, last but not least,
Tenzin Kelsan, who's so happy to have reinforcements tonight. So will you sit up here with me? Rather than starting with a question, maybe each person can just say their name again. So if you want to ask them a question, if you want to say your name, and if you want to repeat anything about what you're doing, or if you want to comment on anything from the slides that's like your life, okay? Then we'll ask some more specific questions. I know Nawang Law. I say Law at the end. You know, have you been to Japan and they say Madeline San? It just shows respect. But okay, so Nawang Law.
Nawang. So I'm Nawang Tongme. I've been here since 1993. Now here after 1998, my family joined, my wife joined. Now I have a son, 14 years old. And then my mother-in-law, she's living with us. And that's it. That's enough?
Yes, that's perfect. That's perfect. We'll just go down. Everyone can say a little something about what they're doing. Tenzin Kelsan, you can say anything you like, that you're happy to be here or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. And let's see, our brave man, would you like to introduce yourself a little? Or not, or we'll ask you a question later, okay? We can do later. Okay, go ahead. All right, okay.
My name is Lobson, and I've been here since 2002, and right now I'm working on construction work in people's homes and building houses, renovation, and so that's pretty much it.
Okay, and Samjit left?
I'm Samjit, and I moved from Washington, D.C. to here 2004. Yeah, but I came to America in 99, so end of 99. And I have two kids, and she's in sixth grade. My son is in third grade. Yeah, it's kind of hard sometimes because my husband is American. And he doesn't speak English, so I have to keep him on and speak. Yeah. I mean, he speaks English, but not Tibetan, so I have to keep telling him speak Tibetan, speak Tibetan.
Okay, so.
My friend, I'm sorry. Yeah,
no, you didn't.
Yeah, first thing, I would like to say Taishidle for Tenzila, behalf of all the Tibetan Association.
That's so nice.
Proud of Tenzila. She became one of the professors in medicine. Yeah, I was very shocked. She has written books and all these things happened after 25 years. I'm very happy about Tenzin. We haven't seen after 25 years, you know? Yeah. So it was a long gap.
Did she look the same?
Pardon?
Did she look the same?
She looks much younger. Only what kind of food she is eating. We are the same country. I eat most of Tibetan food. She looks much younger than me. That was my question for Tenzin. I'm just kidding. I asked her, she looks much younger. Yeah, I'm working in the downtown mall. Charles Flow. I think most of my friends, they know Taishi Dile very well. Every time, back and forth, they know many words in Tibetan too. They know thank you, they have lots of friends. They talk to us every morning, Taishi Dile. So it was very interesting. So I've been here, we are the Naola and Tenzila, we are the first Tibetan came to Charlottesville. And now we have many Tibetans.
Right.
So nice to meet you all.
Thank you so much. Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you. And about how many Tibetan families are there in Charlottesville? It's very, you're very special to have to be one of maybe 26 cities in the United States with a Tibetan Tibetan community.
I think
26 families. Almost close to 100 people, including kids. So we have a lot of little ones. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. And we have Tibetan Sunday School, which held the Unity Church. Mm-hmm.
What church?
Unity Church.
These Saturday schools, or in your case, Sunday school, are such an old immigrant tradition. You've heard of them before, right? The Germans had them, the Norwegians had them, the people who were enslaved had different little schools to try to teach children when they were denied access to other education. But these are parents who are trying to keep something alive, and it's a really wonderful American tradition that's so continuing today. We have quite a few Chinese Saturday schools and Korean Saturday school in Madison, also Russian. Mm-hmm. And yours goes from what time to what time?
2 to 4.
Uh-huh. Yeah, do you go, Sepe, do you go to this school?
Yeah.
And tell us what it's like. What time do you go, and do you take your lunch, and what do you study?
When we get there, we do our prayers first, and then after that, we split into our groups, like how much we know and how many
sections.
Yeah, and so, and we learn, and then we have first.
Do you want to add to that?
And also we have music. Used to be we Getsedena, he's one of the professor, and now he moved away, but he is teaching kids Tibetan language and also in Tibetan instrument, Tibetan Tamyen and Yangji. So we have singing practice, you know, along with the reading and writing.
That's the Tibetan lute and the Tibetan flute, and kind of like a banjo. Well, as promised, a couple questions.
But my question is, could you talk about the symbolism and significance of the white scarf? The giving of the white scarf.
White scarf is something like, in America, you bring the flowers and just put on the table instead of the white scarf. It's a very represent something like the flowers and the gift and respect and everything's there.
Mm-hmm. Honor and respect, and it's used.
Prosperity, love, compassion, everything on our neck.
Mm-hmm.
For the High Lamas, we just offer on the table. So we don't do that. The regular people, it's like everything's there. Good luck and
blessings. And a lot of respect.
And compassion and everything.
Very special time, yeah. Celebration. Mm-hmm. And you were going to say something, Sam Dupla?
Yeah, has eight auspicious sons.
Really. Yeah, this has a lot of meaning. They have Tibetan symbols. There's a design. Can you see the design here? They have a lot of meaning here, too.
Did you say eight
Tibetan
symbols?
I think Sue knows everything better than anyone.
That's great, yes.
We know Sue very well.
That's wonderful. Maybe she'll chime in and introduce and add to the conversation. Would it be okay if we just passed around the kata? It's called a kata.
Yeah,
and
sure.
you can look at the eight auspicious symbols that are so beautifully.
Yeah,
and people just pass around. I think people can. Yeah. Now, if someone asks what they all mean, then you have to take an introduction to Buddhism course, because each one has a great symbolism and history. But they are really beautiful. Mm-hmm, maybe. Okay.
I just have a quick question about people that may be coming from Tibet in current day. Are they still escaping over the mountain, or do they just fly, you know, get a visa and come? I don't know what's happening now.
Nowadays, they come in a helicopter. I'm just kidding. Now everything's shut down. I think even if they want to come, they have to come through the mountain.
So the same way, over the mountain.
It's much harder because when we escape, that time don't have much cameras and stuff like that set up.
Now they have all of it set up. They don't, the armies don't have to get out from the building, so they can watch in the computer. So it's very hard to get out. Mm-hmm. But they still try.
Yeah.
Most, when I was coming out, when every night we walk in the daytime, we sleep for a little bit and stuff like that. But now it's much harder and less people can come over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they don't issue passport at all.
Yeah.
My parents, they live in Tibet and they don't have a Chinese passport. They cannot come. And I have American citizen. I cannot go in. They just, you know, just something hard.
Yeah, it just name of the, we don't change our name. So we are proud of Tibetan. So even we are citizen, but we keep our name. So, if we want to go back, we all citizens here, but it's hard to get the visa to Chinese embassy. They already recognize the name. So, you know, they're holding the passport for months and months, years. So, I've been here 20 years now. Yeah, never get back.
That's terrible.
Yeah, they didn't really say. Yeah, example, I was born in India. They, from very young age, they come from Tibet. Now they want to see their parents, grandparents. They want to just go to visit, not for any other reason. Even they don't want to issue any visa. So that's very sad. Sometimes we don't see each other, you know. Even we cannot communicate in the telephone or something happened, they're going to be in trouble.
My question was about, you said there were 36 Tibetan families here in Charlottesville. Are they mostly from India and Nepal, or is anyone from Tibet? Like, did anyone come directly from Tibet?
Yeah, there is some came direct from Tibet, we have. And also some born in India, their parents living in... No, born in India, their parents living in India. There's maybe a couple in Nepal, but mostly from Tibet, right?
Mostly. Yeah, mostly, you know, like
from exile.
Let's see, mostly Tibetans from Tibet. They came to India and then came through. But then we have few Tibetan families that came direct from Tibet too.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Tibetans born and grew up in India also we have here, mixed together.
Is it easy to go back to India?
Of course, very easy.
India,
India, you know, I was born and grew up in India. India is one of the most helpful country to the Tibetan, and politically little problem, but then little problem always there because they have to take care of their own family and country. So, but like I was born and grew up in India, and during first Indian Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru, and he set up Tibetan school for the Tibetan kids. Otherwise, we can't able to speak and keep anything. You know, like India is a war country, like, Tibetan children are divided, like send three or four in each school, then it's done. But then he spent lots of money and take care, not only for the Tibetan young children, and also for the Tibetan, they set up Tibetan camp. We can have Tibetan community together. So India is really one of the most, India and Indian people are really kind and very generous for the Tibetan. They are the only one who help when needed. Of course, America is really great and wonderful help, but then, 1959, India is the only one who came to help. And now, even not only that, India also, we have, before we called Exile Tibetan Government, now we changed the name because, our host country facing lots of pressure from the China. So now we call the Central Tibetan Administration. So we have like three pillars of same like what we are running here, executive and judiciary and legislative. And so, within India, they allowed us to do these things. Sometimes, they have to play a little bit game with other countries. So we have facing little problem, but mostly very generous, very generous. Like me, I can go back to India anytime. Even, the Tibetan people who were not born in India, they can go back to India anytime. There's no problem. Like if we have holding U.S. passport, they can issue 10 years visa. They are most welcome anytime. So India is really generous and really, not only Indian, India government and Indian people too. And also we have, you know, one thing is India and Tibetan, we have a very, good relation and very link for the culture point of view. Because, you know, Buddhism, the Buddha, he was born in India. So, you know, we are practicing, most of them practice Buddhism. So, you know, there is a lot of good links. And also our language is adopted from the Sanskrit. Sanskrit is one of the oldest Indian language. So due to that reason, and also others, you know, really very great, and we are allowed to go to India anytime. Anytime. No problem.
It's one thing India did right.
Yeah.
Not too many things did. Yeah.
Well, if you compare today in the politics of immigration and refugees, which have always been there. I mean, you can look back at Chinese coming to America or Japanese coming to America. That India was such a poor country at the time in 1959, or it had so much poverty, and opened up its doors to 110,000 and more refugees with a plan and greeting them. I mean, just compare to what's happening in the world today, and to think, and that India appealed to the United Nations many, many times year after year, please help us, we will, you know, we're accepting them, but we have our own poverty, we have our own problems, please everyone take a few. And it's been so long and in such small numbers, you know, 1,000 here and 1,000 to Switzerland, and, you know, but that's out of hundreds of thousands.
That's right.
Yeah, so really saluting India and Nepal. And you came over from, you were born, Lobsang, right, in Tibet. Yes, just to clarify. And I think a lot of people don't understand that refugees, you know, you might be third generation, so you might be ethnic Tibetan in the second or third generation. And it doesn't mean, and it's an exception for, you know, communities that have a Tibetan school, but, you know, kids don't necessarily know. We can say this about all kids of all ethnicities, our own kids. They don't necessarily know their own history or language or things like that. So this is a very precious thing that the Tibetan Association of Charlottesville is doing. And so you really, with a small number of families, have really made a wonderful link of heritage in both directions. So.
But my question is, what was your hope in coming to America? And what are you doing now that you did not do or perhaps could not do before coming here?
Yeah, you know, I finished my school in 92, and everything what I have studied is in Tibetan language. And I had a master's degree on Buddhist philosophy. And when I was in school, I really want to teach not religion, just how to live happy life to the Tibetan children in a school. That was my aim. I want to be a teacher. But then my name comes in a lottery, so I end up here. And then, a really great opportunity. I learn a language and a culture. And also, one thing I can tell you is, you know, I able to share my knowledge to the students at UVA. And what I do is research, she mentioned research. This is research level for Tibetan study, Buddhist study, and contemplative study. And then there are young students, some of them really have lots of problems. So one student, I have class every Wednesday, three, four semesters together. So here, when I ask him, is it helping? If not, then it's wasting both of our time. He said, it's very much helping. So I told him one time, if it's helping, can you send me email how it's helping? So he sent me this. So I feel that, you know, really it's a great opportunity to learn new culture. And at the same time, I can share what I know to the others. So I thought that, you know, I didn't able to miss anything. And I gained really lots from this country. And also living in a really free country. And in India, also is a free country too. Yes.
And a beautiful state.
A beautiful state.
Wow.
Wonderful.
Wow. We're so wonderful. Impressed. Yeah.
And are you arranging marriages?
Charles? No, actually, but sometimes, you know, it's really interesting, you know, like here, of course, you know, there's no way I can arrange marriage for my son. There's no way. You know, but in way back in Tibet and India, that works very well. It's really interesting.
Why couldn't you do it here?
Because, you know, my son will reject if I wish to. But, you know, that's no way. In India and Tibet, it works really well. Yeah, I don't know why.
So do they stay married for life?
Whole life.
Oh, yeah.
Whole life. Whole life.
The divorce rate in India is less than 1%.
Yeah, in Tibet too,
very low.
Everything is arranged marriage. My brother's kids are 17, 18, but my brother, he's never seen a wife, and the wife never seen a husband, still doing the arranged marriage, and still going on.
It was really fascinating. There were all kinds of shades of arranged marriage, and maybe you would comment on this too, because I think it's kind of pan-Asia, like every parent is interested in who their kid marries, right? And you have some strong opinions. Well, I might say some of the Asian parents have very strong interest and curiosity about their kids' marriage, and it's almost like sort of you're pushed forward, but you have the right of refusal. Is that what anyone else is signing up? Okay.
Mm-hmm. I like that question. Arranged marriage. So. Here in America, two or three jobs. There's no time for and marriage, there's a power of marriage. Power of marriage.
Power marriage.
Bring it on, right?
I'm curious if there are other cultural practices, or you mentioned the painting craft that doesn't translate well, but are there things that you find in America that do fit, you know, in just the mix, or things that translate well that Americans enjoy doing, or you share with people and they say, oh, that's so great. I mean, I know that meditation has caught on, you know, from a number of different sources, I guess, but are there things that you find that Americans enjoy besides maybe food?
So, you can learn a lot of stuff here. They have the Demeter Center. You can learn not art, but Buddhism, and also they have Tashichuan in Fifth Street. They have a center there, and for the art ways, so it's hard to find jobs here, and hard to survive. So also I had to get on. I was in India doing a company for work full time, 8 to 5, drawing, painting, all that stuff. But when I got here, I tried the first couple of months and to do something, but you know, you have to sell really pricey, so nobody will want that. So I had to get on something else. So that's why I become construction now. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think your mention of meditation and certainly the different kind of Buddhism and people writing books about mindfulness and class and stuff like that has really changed a part of America, and I think it's really connected spirituality that probably wouldn't be here without His Holiness the Dalai Lama and all of the different kinds of Buddhism that have come, not just Tibetan Buddhism, but... Yeah, that's kind of one of our underlayers of America. It's really that all of you know more about it than I do. So. And are people welcome to come to the Tibetan New Year or some of the...
Yes, if anybody is really interested in Tibet or whatever, you know, come over and eat some great food.
Yeah. Yeah, our door is open for everybody, but we don't have any place to get anything.
And that's why you're meeting at the Unity Temple?
Honestly, I'm joking. Seriously, we wish to have a small community, but we don't have it. Our door is open for
okay. I like it.
Really church, no they door. Are very, very kind for us too. Without them, we don't have our honestly Tibetan class. You know, we have no place. We used to get together. We have a Buddhist center. It's called Taishi Cherling. They have a very small space. Then we used to get there all the time a few years earlier. His Holiness Dalai Lama's birthday, Tibetan New Year, so many kids. Sunday school was there earlier. Then finally the neighbors, they complained and we didn't.
lots of things changed.
So honestly, Tibetan Association of Charlottesville is under Tibetan exile government from Dharamsala, but they have many Buddhist centers is in Charlottesville too. But we are the main Tibetan Association of Charlottesville, which is represented from the Dharamsala city. And that's why Sandula, Lutsala, Noala, everybody working very hard for the Sunday school and Tibetan community. Especially last 2-3 years, we don't have a website.
It's 19 hours.
Mr. Subhash, he helped us. We don't have too many helpers. Honestly, we're a small community. People like me are uneducated, so to whom we don't know.
Do you have folk dances? Do you have dances?
We do, you know, when the once year Dongbu Festival comes, culture show, we do every day in Sunday school.
Once a month, do you have dances?
No, folk dances? We don't do it, but Tibetan New Year, the Dalai Lama's birthday, we do gathering and then we dance in a song, but nothing like once a month.
But for now, it's pretty hard to get together because we don't have much nowhere to really go to meet everybody and kind of relax. So someday, we're hoping that someday we will have small space.
We don't have a website for many years. Last 4 years, Mr. Subhash is a good computer, very good in computer. He and his wife is very helpful for us, you know. He met a website for Tibetan Association of Charlottesville. At the same time, he paid whatever it costs, everything sponsored by Spice.
We do like cultural things like when we meet. I think the Tibetan instruments we play songs and we do dance as well during our meeting. Like in a special occasion, like a New Year or His Holiness birthday celebrations and stuff like that.
Well, we're going to finish with questions and then my able assistant is ready. Okay.
Well, can you teach us how to say goodbye?
Is there a blessing way
yes.
or anything?
Kale phe.
Kale
phe.
Kale
phe. Slowly. Kale phe. Kale phe.
Well, does anyone remember how to say hello? Tashi dele. And do you remember how to say thank you? Tuk tiche. And for go slowly, goodbye?
Galeper.
Galeper. So I really think that we should give a big hand to Mr. Nawang Chakme and Mrs. Bhuti, who just stepped out, and Damyang Nima, yes, and Loksang Dongduk, and also Tenzing Sepe. So great.
I hope that you enjoyed that talk from Madeline Uranek. A big thank you to her for allowing us to record it, as well as her visiting Tibetan friends and members of the local Tibetan community for coming out and answering questions that attendees had. We'd also like to thank the Friends of the Library, whose generous support makes this podcast, as well as those kinds of events, possible. The Friends of the Library Fall Book Sale actually begins in just a couple of days. There's a members-only pre-sale starting this Friday, tomorrow, if you're listening on the day this comes out, from 5 to 7 p.m. If you're interested in becoming a friend of the library, visit jmrlfriends.org to find out how to do that so that you can attend the pre-sale. For the rest of the general public, the book sale begins Saturday, that's November 3rd, and runs through Sunday, November 11th. It takes place at the Gordon Avenue Library and runs from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. every day. So once again, thank you to the Friends of the Library for all of their generous support, and if you want to help support the Friends, you can do so either by donating or becoming a friend at jmrlfriends.org or by attending the book sale. That's it for us today. If you haven't already, hit subscribe wherever it is that you're listening to this podcast. Please do so now so you don't miss any of our upcoming episodes. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another recording of an event that took place at one of our libraries. But until then, thanks for tuning in, and we're glad to be on the same page.